Welcome to the 1 p.m. session, A&R and Discographical Research. We have three speakers in this session. The first of them is Barry Mazur, speaking on Unseen Documents from the Career of Ralph Peer. Barry's a longtime music, media, and business journalist. He's won several awards, and he's a regular contributor to the Wall Street Journal and to the online music magazine Medium/Q Point. He's also the author of Meeting Jimmy Rogers and Connie Smith, Just for What I Am. He's the former senior editor and columnist for No Depression magazine, and his work has appeared in numerous publications, including American Songwriter, The Nashville Scene, The Village Voice, and The Washington Post. He was awarded the Charlie Lamb Award for Excellence in Country Music Journalism in 2008. And if you want his stuff, his publisher is Chicago Review Press. Barry Mazur.
Yeah, this book is Oxford University Press would want me to mention that Meeting Jimmy Rogers was from them. All right. Glad you're here. I'd invite anybody who wants to get a better look at some of the things I'm going to show to come forward, because there's pictures. There's also documents where if you want to read some of the type yourself, you're better off close. And thanks in any case for being here. So, Ralph Peer, I've got his life story out this year. It's called Ralph Peer and the Making of Popular Roots Music. And the man's been dead for 55 years, and there's never been a serious, prolonged study of his life and his work. That means, and probably everyone in this room knows this name, connects him with certain things. Tendency is, if you're in country music, you say Bristol. If you're in jazz, you say, well, what did he do with the Hot Fives and Sevens? If you're in blues, you say, oh, Blind Willie McTell. And so it goes. And you might not know that he was the biggest influence on Latin music in around the world to boot. But those have all been separate. Since his story has not been told, he's been defined by other people. And there are a lot of mythologies, misconceptions about who he was, what he did, and what he meant to do. I have had access to, for the first time, through his family's cooperation with his project, his notes, his papers, the royalty statement, his wife's diaries, the photos, family films, much stuff that has never been available to anybody, including me, when I was writing about Jimmy Rogers 5 years ago. Learned a lot. And what I wanted do today is show you some of the documents behind this that are not yet available. Some of these are scattered in archives, but most of these are in the Peer family's private papers yet. And within a few years, they will move to some public availability. But I just want to show you the kind of things that we can now, that I was able to see in order to do the book. Very quickly. Ralph Peer had a 50-year career. It breaks down very simply. It was 1910 to 1960. The first 25 of those 50 years was the period we're going to concentrate on today, when he was a prototypical A&R man. He was influential, seminal, important in establishing musical genres for regional roots music and audiences who hadn't been addressed. In the second half of that career, he became a full-time publisher, eventually the head of the largest independent global publisher in the world. Peer Southern is in 28 countries to this day, and it's still independent and family-owned. That's the story. We're going to concentrate on the early years. Who was this guy, and where did he come from, and what did he do? Contrary to the idea that he was a city slicker from New York City who'd been to the Ivy League and descended on poor folks, this is where he came from. He was the son of a displaced farmer and a coal miner's daughter. The coal miner's daughter, by the way, actually grew up at the current location of the Pittsburgh Airport. Displaced, his father had a store in Independence, Missouri, several really, the Peer Supply Company, that's an ad. And the white door over on the right-hand side of that street in this street photo of 1909, that is the A.B. Peer Supply Company. They sold two things. They sold sewing machines and talking machines. A lot of cranks, spinning wheels, and replaceable needles. By the age of 10, his son Ralph was getting on a trolley on those tracks you see there, going downtown and doing odd jobs for the original old Columbia Records. He never stopped working in the music business for the rest of his life. This, third from the top there, is Ralph here in his high school class of 1909 at Kansas City Central High. And next to it is a fascinating article, I thought, and it's from the papers in Independent, and it discusses his father taking an early record player, a Columbia Graphophone, out to the poor farm in the area and playing records, what were described as old familiar tunes that made people cry, for the poor people at the poor farm. It was the first time any of them had ever heard a record player. That there was a father and son shared tendency, I think, gets to be obvious. He works, when he gets out of high school, he was of scientific bent in mind. He might have gone to electrical engineering school. He didn't have the money. He was fascinated by biology all of his life and became a world-class expert on camellias, of all things, as a side business. But instead of doing all those things, he went directly to work for Columbia Records. This ad from 1912 has two interesting people in it. The top row, second from the left, is W.C. Fury, his boss, who he will follow to OK Records right after World War I. And if you look, that's Ralph Peer, traveling salesman out of Kansas City, Missouri. In that capacity, he traveled around the country, he met the dealers, he learned what people in one town wanted over another, he learned who hadn't been served. After the war, a job had been held open for him at Columbia, and he got back there and discovered that Fury had moved on to this new place. Otto Heinemann had decided to start a record label to be called OK, they're moving to New York, why don't you come? He did. And he was a general assistant. You couldn't call him an A&R man at first. He was in sales, he was around. You know, it was a startup company and you do odd jobs. Eventually they tested his ear. The result of this is, while he was at OK, Ralph Peer would record the first country record. With Mamie Smith, he would oversee the first blues record. With Sylvester Weaver, the first blues record with a guitar. With James P. Johnson, the first jazz piano solo. He would greenlight the Hot Fives and Sevens. He would establish and expand on each of these areas as he became head of A&R for what became the Race and Hillbilly lines there. We have some documents to show you here. This is, that's an ad in Talking Machine World announcing that they were going to make records by black people for black people. It was a new concept. It was picked up by others. What you see next to it is a rare piece of peer writing. This is Ralph Peer to Sarah Martin, the blues singer that you see in the ad. And the gist of this was, the record she'd made with Sylvester Weaver on guitar behind her singing blues is hot stuff. It's taken off like nothing they've seen. He's suggesting that she feature it in her live act. He's also suggesting that he wants to sign Sylvester Weaver as a soloist as soon as possible. And they want to be as good to him as possible so he doesn't go to any other label. And by the way, when he plays guitar to bear down on the strings. So that's who Ralph Peer is within a couple years of starting to work for OK. He was involved with his artists, black and white. He was involved with the music. If you heard, he was a disconnected businessman who had no relation to the music he recorded. It wasn't true in the relationships, and it wasn't true in the music. This gets us up to one of the historical episodes that I'm able to correct, update, and set straight, which has to do with the birth of country music. Now, the story we've all lived with was by the great Archie Greene that on Hillbilly Sign and Symbol, which for over 50 years is the way we've heard that the first location recording session deliberately set up by a recording company to go and get artists in Atlanta in 1923, was a spur-of-the-moment thought by Polk Brockman, a record jobber in Atlanta, that oh, there was this hillbilly guy, maybe that will work. Well, none of that was the way that played out. The documentation will show, some of which was even in the Atlanta Constitution, but until our current moment of newspaper database availability, it wasn't there to say. That bottom paragraph down there tells the real story. They had been working on the idea of location recording for some time, and it was a simple economic matter that most people in this room will probably recognize. They had been looking for talent all over the country. It's expensive to do that. The record business had reached a kind of a high point of sales, 1920, and it started to slack off a little. They were looking for new ways to stimulate business. Radio had started at the local level. It is not an accident that SC Radio in Atlanta is owned by the Constitution, who covers this story, and they decide to go there. What they were waiting for, essentially, was the technology to be ready. Nobody really had it that was reliable enough to get a decent recording when you went on the road. They arrived at it. They were already planning to go to Chicago to the NAMM convention when this came up. So they said, okay, we'll go to Atlanta. There was no spur of the moment thought about Fiddlin' John Carson. They were going there to record that band, which was a pop group that sang songs about sheiks and the Sheik of Araby and frat houses. And they were coming to New York, and you can follow the articles for weeks. They say, they're going to go record with OK in New York City. It's great. They're going to be out of town. You won't be able to see their shows. Right there is the change. They said an added interest is that they're bringing a studio to Atlanta. They did not even have the terminology for location recording. But, of course, it wasn't a permanent studio in Atlanta. They went. They recorded Fiddlin' John Carson. And, by the way, 3 days later, they were right back in Chicago with that same unit recording King Oliver with Louis Armstrong. That's what a week in the life of Ralph Peer could be like, sometimes the same day. The only recorded lengthy interview with Peer, which some of you may have even heard, is a fairly famous one he did with a reporter named Lou Borgeson, which is almost 8 hours long. He did near the end of his life. This is another one. This was also in the last year of his life. It was played on the 4th of July, where Don Owens, the country disc jockey, was doing a salute to early country music. And best I can make out, what happened here is Ralph Peel sat in his office in Hollywood and recorded this discussion of the Fiddlin' John Carson session and sent it to him in Washington to play. So this is a virtually unheard since 1959 comment from Ralph Peer about that day in Atlanta.
Carson was an old-time circus performer. When we brought him in, he produced for the first side the well-known selection, The Little Old Log Cabin in the Lane. And for the reverse, he used The Old Hen Cackled and The Rooster's Going to Crow. This was a very difficult recording proposition because this was long before the invention of the so-called electronic recording system. We had to use large horns, and it was really troublesome getting both the fiddle played by Carson and his voice all into the mouth of the one horn. When the wax recording got back to New York and had been processed, I listened to these two items, and believe me, they were terrible. Nevertheless, we pressed 1,000 records for Mr. Brockman and sent them to him by express. I took the precaution of eliminating the catalog number from the label, as I could not believe such a bad recording could be used. The shipment arrived in Atlanta on a Thursday evening, and by 10 o'clock on Friday morning, Mr. Brockman had me on the telephone to request that I rush 10,000 more records by express immediately.
So if you've heard the famous thing supposedly said by Ralph Pure that that record was pluperfect, awful, first of all, that's not a phrase he used. That was a description of his attitude. It was not about the music. It was not about the singing. He was not impressed with the quality of their first recording out on location. They brought Fiddlin' John to New York and made hundreds of records with him, and he became, in effect, the first hillbilly star. But that's been widely misunderstood. On the strength of what he'd done at OK, he was picked up by Victor, still Victor Talking Machine, just barely, to become a consultant in A&R with the express purpose of building all of their popular roots music lines. It was hillbilly in particular they were interested in, but in fact he was put in charge of all of them, which meant he was involved with jazz, he was involved with blues, and within a year, also with Latin. These documents go into something which has been misunderstood widely in the Pure story also. It's widely known that when he got to Victor, he cut a deal with them which was unprecedented, which had to do with being paid by the publishing on the songs, by the mechanical rights. It's interesting because people regularly have written that he became fabulously wealthy off of this deal, when everybody knows that within a couple of years the record market collapsed, and how you're supposed to be getting that rich from mechanicals with nobody selling any records is something that should have occurred to somebody. At first, that worked very well. Masses of money came in that they hadn't been bothering to collect. He also deliberately fostered the recording of songs by other labels, some things that record labels were not wildly interested in doing, particularly if they had any piece of the publishing. But in fact, if you see a Jimmy Rogers royalty statement, and we'll see a piece of one of those shortly, the money starts rolling in from all those covers of his songs by other artists and all those other labels. This is like a new world. What we have here are two of his actual contracts with Victor. The first one, and they increasingly aware of how much money he was making at first, and this is 1928 when he was. So, in fact, the first one is the second iteration of the mechanical deal they kept dickering with to see if they could keep more of it. And they finally said, look, this can't go on. The truth was, by the end of 1928, he was in a deal where he was paid by a percentage of the actual profits on the recordings. He did get more if he found them fresh. There was an emphasis on new songs, but he wasn't living on mechanicals forever. In any case, he got wealthy later. The money that he made early on with the Jimmy Rogers and the Carter families and et cetera went back into his publishing business. He lived a modest middle class lifestyle, living with his in-laws in East Orange, New Jersey, was the truth of it, which was a good place to go into New York and to Camden at the same time. And a lot of people worked for Heinemann and lived there. Next, Southern music publishing clients write. The files are full of these. You see there. Often it's about money. The first one is a note from W.C. Handy that this is like the exchange of money. He was representing Handy's publishing company around the world further. So there's a note from W.C. Handy, which is that, you know, send the money there. Basically, he was advancing the money. So these are agreements to send the next checks to Southern Music. That's W.C. Handy. The middle one is Fats Waller. The next one is very interesting. That is from Blind Willie McTell, written by his wife and dictated by Willie. And if you look at it, it says, Mr. Pure, I'm not living in Statesboro anymore. Please send my money to Atlanta. There's lots of that. That's something people talk to their A&R guy about. Okay, about sessions. Henry Widder to Pure. Now, is Henry Widder a familiar name in here? Grayson and Widder, early country star, this kind of thing. He was somebody who Pure had, among many artists, who followed Pure from OK to Victor when they went there. There was this close relation in Victor. There was more money in than there had been at OK. That's a note in Widder's handwriting that tells him that Mr. Grayson has just been killed in an accident. And by this point, the Depression's on. It's 1930, the next set of things we're looking at. And he's saying, please let me record with a new partner. And by the way, Pure did that and kept him rolling. The other note is quite interesting. This is Ralph Pure to Lauren Watson, one of his A&R bosses at by now RCA Victor. And they are talking about Jim Jackson of Memphis Jug Band fame. and what will be done with him. And essentially, the most interesting part to me, it's all interesting, but it's like, Jackson doesn't have new numbers. We love him. He's been great. But in fact, most of the sales, it's 1930, are with rural African Americans. And in fact, he's become too hip for the room. This has to do with the fact that a lot of the people who've been buying jazz or vaudeville blues records had moved on to radio. And in fact, in the early Depression, they were buying less, which is one of the reasons that acoustic blues or and simple hillbilly started to be recorded. People without rural electrification yet and without much money for radio were still buying records. And so some of the sort of folkizing of the records had to do with who was now the hotter market. This is the kind of stuff that we all wish, I wish there were hundreds of. This is directly from the Memphis session of May 1930. If you look on there, there's Memphis Mini, there's the first session with Bucca White, there's the Memphis Jug Band. Later in the week, the Carter family were there too. These are actual peer notes from the session, cut by cut, back to Victor saying, this one's good. We don't have anything like this gospel number. Get it out fast. This should be paired with this. We could spend an hour just on this page, but this is not the day to do it. But this stuff exists, is what I want you to know. It's the kind of stuff that we've all looked for. Next, looking at my time. I wrote a book called Meeting Jimmy Rodgers, and I had certain ideas about Pierre's relation to Rodgers. I have different ideas now. It has to do with a stack of correspondence back and forth this thick, which I and nobody else ever had before. There's a couple examples here. I just say, what's the difference? Their relationship, which was close, personal. Jimmy was a guy who called him, who called him Ralph, not Mr. Pierre, like most of them did. I don't think he called anybody Mr. anything. But it was a close working partnership. It was so like a current manager with his big ticket artists that it's surprisingly amusing. These notes, which are, it's difficult for me to read on here, it may be easier up there, but essentially there's such things as preparing for the next session, what kind of song you ought to do, where are we going to meet to record, and also don't spend so much money, I'm worried about your health, things are bad in the record business now. Think, you know, it's like Jimmy Rodgers had been selling 500,000-600,000 copies of record. He's still what Ralph is calling the top of the heap here, but it's now 5,000-10,000 records, and it's getting hard to live. He's looking for work for him in England. It goes on like that. You can track exactly how they were working and living. Here's a good example. This is an example of a copyright issue. There were a couple of these. If you follow that, the first is the way Whisper Your Mother's Name was first issued as a Jimmy Rodgers song. Below is, I believe, an Australian release where you see there's now two songwriters on it. And the note is Ralph Peer to Jimmy, like, what are you doing? I told you we need fresh songs, different versions, this kind of thing. This thing's been published. He included a copy of the sheet music. It was note for note the same. He says, you know, don't have, let this happen again. We've talked about this. That's where the note goes. And it happened one other time anyway. Let's see here. Where are we? Here's a Jimmy Rodgers, telegram to Ralph Peer. Their correspondent was constant from the road. This one takes some explaining, but it shows you the kind of money we're talking about at that time. Jimmy was involved in a lawsuit from his first wife who came out of the woodwork with a daughter when it turned out he was rich. Nobody even knew she was there. And they're after a whole lot of money. So basically what this says is, in Jimmy telegram ease, lawsuit comes up 28, send me check for $2,000, besides difference coming to me after my two notes are paid, etc. He then lists a series of 8-9 more gigs that aren't on historical record. He played somewhere practically every day, sick or not. Anyway, $2,000 is a lot of money at this time. It's more than most people made in several years, but it's the kind of thing Rodgers and Pierre can talk about, just send me the check. There you are. Here are some actual Rodgers royalty statements, both on the publishing and numbers on the records. These have almost all survived. And you can watch through this process. They're quarterly statements. And you can see the sales on each record as they change. You can see which ones hit, which one never hit. You can see Ralph Peer saying things to him like, next session, don't record ballads, we can't move them. And here's the money coming in. Jimmy Rogers was becoming a wealthy man, though he spent a lot of it. Wait, did I just skip a, yes, I did. I skipped a piece of audio I'm going to go back to. No? Huh. Okay, well, I have Pierre talking about Jimmy. Any case, he was just saying, he was talking on the Borgeson tape about being close, being friendly, being familiar, and you could keep Jimmy happy if you sent if you kept sending money, which is basically the way he kept him happy. He also bought him a mansion, but that's a different story. Here's something I begin the book with, which I think is a really significant handle on how Ralph Peer saw himself. Certainly not as a preservationist, not as an analog to a Lomax. He was an A&R man who wanted to find commercial records and sell them. And so he was asked in 1955 by the folklorist John Greenway, you know, what were your contributions to American folk music? And among the highlights of the record is what you see here. As the pioneer in this field, I perhaps set the pattern which has resulted in a really tremendous new section of the amusement industry. I quickly discovered that people buying records were not especially interested in hearing standard or folkloric music. What they wanted was something new, built along the same lines. Accordingly, I made it a rule not to use any artist for recording who could not compose his own repertoire. This rather radical departure from the traditions of the recording industry paid off in a big way. By this device, it was possible to popularize new artists because the public liked a new song, or to popularize a new song because the public liked a certain artist. These same principles operate to this day, with the result that thousands of future folkloric songs have been created. Every year, Mrs. Peer and I visit the National Hillbilly Music Festival at Meridian, Mississippi, and of course, we will be there this year. I hope you will join us, Ralph Peer. I have one last thing to finish with here, because we're near the end of the half hour. The only 2 minutes of film footage of Ralph Peer that exist, as far as I know. By the time they were global publishers in the late 40s, Mr. and Mrs. Peer would go around the world checking in on their different units, and this is Ralph Peer, who you will notice is not in those kind of poses that you often see where he looks like you ought to be afraid of him. But this is the actual guy, how he moved. It's silent, they're home movies. Most of them were taken by him, which is interesting for a biographer. But these are a few moments around the world. You'll see India, Egypt, it's South Africa, Australia, where he stepped in front of the camera, and I'd like to share that with you. I played this in the Country Music Hall of Fame with a bluegrass breakdown behind it, and it kind of worked, but he was publishing Bill Monroe and that by that point. So. There's 2 minutes more footage of Ralph Peer than anybody's ever seen before. So. That is Mrs. Peer. That is not their kids. That's a local executive's kid. That was Monique Peer, who followed him as head of Peer Southern Music for another 20 years. And their son, Ralph II, is head of the company to this day. Ralph Peer on a camel at the pyramids. Also getting off a camel, which is more of a trick as far as I can tell. That's it.
Yeah, you'll see in a second. Yeah.
He was not the slim youth that I showed you in those 1918 pictures. In his lifetime, at one point in his lifetime, they said he looked like Herbert Hoover. I don't know. And there's some truth to that. I think you're going to see that shot start to pop up in more films now after we let this loose. Yeah. And I have a contest for this one. Anybody who can tell me what they're talking about. Somebody said it's because little Jimmy Dickens got a contract that year, but I don't know. I don't know. Something is just so high. One last thing, and we'll call this a half hour. Murray Deutsch, who worked for Peer in the 50s. Most of you, if you know that name, you know him from the Buddy Holly story, also published by Ralph Peer globally. And Mr. and Mrs. Deutsch were staying at the Peer's house in Hollywood with the 3,000 camellia varieties out front. And they noticed that there was all this, like, this conga drum being played up on a hill in a little house behind them. I said, "What's that?" And I said, "Oh, that's Marlon Brando. He lives in the house on a, he lives on a, he rents our house up behind us." And that was considered odd and unlikely. And there is the letter from Marlon Brando to the Peers, thanking them for use of the house for through the height of his movie career in the 50s, whenever he was in Hollywood. He lived on their grounds and he played a conga drum all day, you know, hipster. And that's it. And I just have one last piece of advice, which is, thank you. That's it for today. Oh, yes, the book is available everywhere, including an enhanced ebook version, which we spent months negotiating, it seemed right, which has 49 full music tracks from all through the years in the book. So, all right.